You're listening to the podcast, Send Me. Here with you is host, Jason Sweet.
Constant forward movement.
What career field are you going for, Romeo Sierra?
How bad do you want what you're trying to accomplish?
Team,
what's your effort in?
1, 2, 3. Thunder!
Brought to you by SOCOM Athlete. Send Me.
Thanks for listening to SOCOM Athlete's podcast, Send Me. This is your host, Jason. What you're about to hear today in this episode is of the highest importance and continues to be a highly debated, controversial topic, Christianity in the United States military. For those unaware, the United States military presupposes a Christian worldview. We have chaplains, generally captains and majors, that wear a cross as their badge. In the United States military, each unit has them. My PJ team had several chaplains over the course of my 6 years at the 306 Rescue Squadron. To go deeper, it's in our Pledge of Allegiance, One Nation Under God, and printed on our very own United States dollar, the world's most used currency, are the words, "In God we trust." These are facts. And to describe more of these facts, Christianity in the military, who better to come on than Dr. Frank Turek, former naval aviator, author of bestseller, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. He's the president of crossexamine.org. He hosts a radio program that's aired on 180 different channels, as well as a podcast titled the same as the book, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. He's been on national television several times, including the show The O'Reilly Factor. He writes a column for townhall.com and so much more. In this episode, we'll interview Dr. Turek, as well as hop on live Q&A with SOCOM Athlete students to ask Dr. Turek any questions they may have about any of these topics discussed. So let's bring on the man himself, Dr. Frank Turek. Thanks for coming on the SOCOM Athlete podcast. How are you, brother?
I'm great, Jason. Thanks for having me on. Always great to be with you. Love the work you're doing.
Thank you. And we love the work you're doing as well. And for listeners out there, the first time I met Frank, he was doing a presentation at the University of Arizona. And he opened up with the story of Michael Mansour, fallen Navy SEAL, Medal of Honor recipient, who actually fell on a grenade to save his teammate's life in Ramadi. And so here we have Frank tonight. And Frank is willing to tackle some challenging questions that maybe a lot of you, as our listeners out there, have thought about and have wrestled with. Frank is the gentleman that I look up to whenever I have any type of question for direction. So it really is an honor to have you on here tonight, Frank. Thank you so much, man.
My pleasure. Great being with you.
Let's get right into it, Frank. We hear this question quite a bit. Can a Christian, somebody who is following Jesus Christ, join the military? Does that work? Is that something that's doable?
Yeah, I hope so, because I was in the Navy for 8 years.
Well, there you go.
So, yeah, of course. And there's a number of reasons for that. One reason is because the scriptures actually talk about just wars. They talk about self-defense. They talk about governments being instituted among men, just like our Declaration of Independence says, by God in order to protect innocent people from evil. And that's what government is called to do. In fact, if you look at the book of Romans, the famous book that Paul wrote to the church at Rome, in chapter 13, he lays out that the ruler, in this case, in our case, being the government, doesn't bear the sword for nothing. In other words, the ruler has the ability and the duty to use the sword to protect innocent people from evil. In fact, that's the number one role of government, to protect innocent people from evil. That's why governments exist. As James Madison famously said in Federalist 51, he said, if men were angels, no government would be necessary. The problem is we're not angels. We're fallen. It's easy to be bad. It's hard to be good. So you need governments in place to protect innocent people from evil. So it's a very noble profession to be part of a government that protects innocent people from evil. And that goes for the military. That also goes for police. You see, they do basically the same thing. They just do it to different audiences. You know, the military is protecting us from evil people outside the government. And generally, the police are supposed to be protecting us from guilty, or I should say, evil people inside the nation. So they do the same kind of thing, and they're both necessary.
Wow. Thank you for that, Frank. Question, though. When we talk about the military these days, especially as we go into the future, you're looking at a lot of jobs, maybe working at a gym or doing cybersecurity or some administrative work or mechanic work that potentially may never see actually holding a firearm, aggressing the enemy, combat jobs in particular. What are your thoughts on that? In a world where God has given us the freedom of choice and we choose to do a job that could put us on the battlefield, potentially neutralizing the enemy. What do you think about that, Frank?
Well, that's, if we didn't have people to do that, then the military wouldn't be very useful, would it? Because that's what it's there to do. It's there to protect innocent people from evil. And sometimes it has to use force to do so. But just a deterrent factor, Jason, as you well know, when we pull an aircraft carrier off the coast of Iran, that's sending a message to evil governments that want to do harm to innocent people. And just doing that most of the time prevents hostilities from taking place. You don't prevent a war through weakness. You prevent a war through strength. And it's a deterrent just to have a military, even one you never have to use. In fact, you hope you never have to use it. By the way, the same thing is true when it comes to police. Having a police presence can prevent evil from breaking out where you don't even have to use force. And that's really the goal. You want to maintain the peace, both with a police force and or with a military. Now, once hostilities do break out, the goal is to restore the peace. That's what the military and that's what police forces are supposed to do. Restore the peace with the minimal amount of force necessary.
And Frank, we've seen throughout the Bible, the Old Testament, even the New Testament, that some had to use deadly force in order to serve some type of purpose or in order for a mission to get done for God. So can you touch a little bit more on why God would potentially lead someone in the military and what would justify someone to go into the military doing a combat job, perhaps?
Well, let's just go back to World War II for just a second. Because World War II, the great second world war that we had in the past century, here you have a maniacal madman trying to sweep across Europe and also sweep over into Russia. And Hitler, of course, attacked countries that had no hostility toward Germany, but he wanted to basically rule the world. If we're called to love our neighbors, and we are, how can we love our neighbors if we fail to protect them from that kind of evil? We're not loving our neighbors when we allow someone like that to try and annihilate them and put them under subjugation, which is what Hitler tried to do. To use a personal example, suppose somebody broke into your house and was about to shoot your wife, and you had the ability to stop it. Would you be loving your wife if you chose not to stop that perpetrator? No, you wouldn't be loving your wife at all. It would be a dereliction of duty if you didn't use force in that situation, right? So sometimes in order to love people, you have to use force to protect them from evil. And that's what we did in World War II. That's what we do on a individual level in self-defense. If someone's trying to hurt us or hurt our family, we use force to try and love them by protecting them through the use of force. So again, if we didn't have people willing to do this, we wouldn't even have a civilization. We wouldn't have freedom. We wouldn't have the ability to live the way we do. We would be either dead or under subjugation from evil people.
So Frank, you bring up the word evil. If we are going to define that there is good and evil in the world, then there must be right and wrong. There must be yes and no, some type of truth, and not just a truth that we know to be true, but a truth that everybody knows to be true. So question for you, Frank, how can we identify truth? How can we say that there is indeed good and evil?
Well, we know that there is good and evil just from our own intuitions. Like if I say to somebody, is torturing babies for fun wrong? Obviously, everyone's going to say, well, of course it is. The next question is, why is it wrong? If it's just my opinion, it's not really wrong. But if my opinion is actually just incongruent with God's nature, and I say, yes, I know why it's wrong, because God exists. And therefore, if God exists, it's not just my opinion that something is right or wrong. It's really wrong, and I just seem to recognize it. In other words, we don't determine right and wrong. We discover right and wrong. And only if God exists is torturing babies for fun wrong, is murdering 6 million people in a Holocaust wrong. It's not just the government saying, well, I think it's wrong. In fact, if we were to say that the government determines right and wrong rather than discovers right and wrong, then we would have no way to convict the Nazis of their war crimes. You know, when we went to Nuremberg, Germany, we had the Nuremberg trials after World War II. We told the Nazis that they were wrong for murdering innocent people. And what did the Nazis say? Well, we were just following the orders of our government. And what did we say in response? You have a greater obligation to obey the law above your government. That's what we call international law. It's also called the moral law. Thomas Jefferson in our Declaration of Independence called it nature's law. Essentially, what that is God's nature. That's the law above the law. That's the law that helps us differentiate between us and the Nazis. We could say that we're closer to that law than the Nazis when we said what we were fighting for was closer to what God wants than what the Nazis were fighting for. The Allies were right and the Nazis were wrong because we were comparing them both to a standard beyond both of them. And that standard, Jason, as you know, can only exist if God exists. If there's no God, everything's just a matter of opinion. This is why Jefferson and the other founding fathers said, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men were created equal and endowed by their creator, not by their government, but by their creator, with certain inalienable rights. Among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And then he goes on to say, Jefferson does in the Declaration of Independence, he said that governments are instituted among men, not to give these rights, not to take away these rights, but to secure these rights. And he goes on later to say that if the government doesn't secure these unalienable rights that come from the creator, then men have the ability to get a new government. And that was the foundation for the struggle for independence. Because if you read the Declaration of Independence, you read all these immoral things that King George was doing to the colonists. And Jefferson and the other founding fathers said, George was legislating immorality on us. And therefore, we have a right to overthrow him, to kick him out of our land, because he was not legislating properly according to the moral law, according to nature's law, the Declaration of Independence. And that comes from God.
That's powerful, Frank. So we as Americans have an objective moral standard to enforce. And our government, in situations like, Frank, you see in over 50 countries, we are combating the jihad, radical Islam, terrorism. And we have to have some type of governance that says killing 40 innocent people in a car bomb to strike fear or put a message in, that's wrong. And we are going to fight you and we are going to combat you for that because it is wrong. Who else is going to do that besides America? There's a couple other countries that join us in the fight, and maybe they have incentive for that. Maybe they don't. But we seem to be one of the only, if not the only country in the world that is going and enforcing that objective moral standard. What are your thoughts on that, Frank?
Well, that's true. And we have to, of course, be very careful in how we and where we enforce that, because it is difficult, as you know, to be the policeman of the world. But we tend to do that when we think our national security interests are at stake. And sometimes we do it in a humanitarian way where we're trying to protect innocent people from evil. So, yes, that's an absolutely critical part of our military now is engaging the enemy on their ground rather than waiting for them to come over to here and do that same kind of thing to us like they did on 9/11. I mean, it is pretty amazing, Jason, when you think of it, that largely we've been able to prevent a major jihad attacks in America for the past 20 years after that massive one on 9/11. And without the military, we wouldn't be able to do that. Without intelligence, we wouldn't be able to do that. Imagine if we had a 9/11 every few weeks here in America. We wouldn't be here. So it's necessary. In fact, I think it was Francis Schaeffer, who was a Christian apologist a number of years ago. He said, in a fallen world, some kind of force is going to be necessary. In a fallen world, some kind of force is going to be necessary. By the way, Jesus even pointed that out when he told his disciples, and let me get the exact reference here. I think it is Luke 22, 36. He actually told his disciples, if they don't have a sword, go buy one. Now, why do you think he would say that? Not to use it in an offensive way, not to use it to try and get people to convert to Christianity. You can't get people to convert to anything by force. Not reasonably anyway. He told them to get a sword apparently for self-defense, because you have a right to defend yourself against evil. And the government has the obligation to protect innocent people from evil. That's why governments exist.
Well said, Frank. And question for you, in a time where we have so many different choices, we could potentially pursue a college degree and a job that involves working at a corporation, moving up that ladder, or potentially join a job in the military that maybe doesn't involve combat, etc. So what does God say about killing? Because you've seen the Ten Commandments, and we've seen interpretation of the Ten Commandments. Some say, thou shalt not kill. Others say, thou shalt not murder. So What does God think about somebody that is directly making a decision to do a job in the military that is going to put them in a situation where they're going to kill? Is that wrong?
Yeah, no. It's a great question. And the people that sign up for this kind of duty are noble people because, as I mentioned earlier, it's necessary in some instances to use force. And if you don't use force, then you're allowing evil to overrun innocent people, and we can't allow that to happen. Now, there is a difference between murder and killing. The great commandment says, thou shalt not murder. It doesn't say thou shalt not kill, because sometimes killing is justified. According to Exodus 22, if a thief breaks into your house and you try and resist him and the guy dies, that's not your fault. That's self-defense. So self-defense is justified. Killing in a just war is justified. So if you're a member of a legitimate government and you're involved in a just war and you kill the opponent, that's justified. And as I mentioned earlier, it might even be necessary to protect innocent people from evil. It would be a dereliction of duty if you didn't do it, if you're involved in a just war. If you ran away in battle and left your buddies out there vulnerable and then didn't, and not only that, but by not carrying out your duty, you're endangering not only them, but the people back home. Yeah, that's a dereliction of duty. Also, governments have the obligation, or let's just put it another way, they have the capacity to kill people who have committed capital crimes. So capital punishment is actually allowed by the Bible in both the Old and the New Testaments. In the Old Testament, it's Genesis 9:6. In the New Testament, Jesus is with Pilate, and Pilate says to him, after Pilate asks him a question, do you know that I have the authority to kill you? And Jesus didn't say, no, you don't. Capital punishment's immoral. He said this. He said, yes, you do, but you get that authority from above. In other words, God gives government the rightful authority to mete out capital punishment for people who commit crimes that are capital crimes. So there are differences between killing and murder. Killing, in the right circumstances, is justified and sometimes necessary. Murder is not justified because it's the taking of an innocent human being. In fact, think about 9/11 for a second. You know, when that plane was heading toward the Capitol, that we apparently scrambled F-16s to take that plane down, knowing that were innocent people on it. Why did we do that? Because Our intent was not to kill innocent people. Our intent was to prevent evil people from killing even more innocent people. So it was a situation we were caught in a dilemma. Do we allow this plane to keep heading toward the Capitol? Or do we take action that, although difficult, will save a lot of lives? And what we chose to do was we chose to take fewer lives in order to prevent the taking of greater life. Now, thankfully, the people on the plane apparently decided they were going to do what they could to prevent that from happening. And the plane went down in Shanksville, Pennsylvania anyway. But those planes were in the air. And I've heard, I haven't verified this, but I've heard that they didn't have time to arm those planes, Jason. What they were going to do was they were going to ram those F-16s into the plane to take it down, possibly costing the pilots their own lives if they couldn't eject. But sometimes that's necessary. And you know this, you've been on the battlefield, you've been over there in Afghanistan. Sometimes you got to put out a lot of fire, and unfortunately, some innocent people are going to get hurt, but it's the least worst choice you have, right? But we're going to try and take out these bad guys to minimize the amount of damage. And as you know, in America, we try and do everything we can to prevent the loss of innocent life, but sometimes it's unavoidable. Sometimes you've got to send that drone strike in there. Sometimes you've got to send that Tomahawk missile in there. Sometimes you have to send a fire team and put a whole bunch of lead downrange, even though you know that some innocent people might get hit, because there's no better choice. It's the least worst choice you can take.
That's very powerful, Frank, and I appreciate you sharing those words, because for most of our listeners out there, they are getting ready to go into their special operations training pipeline. And what's at the end of that pipeline? Getting ready for a deployment, getting ready for missions, combat, and they need to be mentally ready for that. In our previous episode with Matt Height, I know I've introduced you to Matt. We talk about the moral obligation, and we talk about moral argument. And we also talk about Matt's time and what it essentially goes into this decision-making process on killing, and whether killing is justified or whether it's something that's being done for a murderous act or something that's essentially being done for wrath or revenge. Frank, what are your thoughts when you hear somebody say, I want to join the military because I want to shoot people in the face?
Well, I remember listening to that podcast you did with Matt, and he brought up a very good point that you don't want to go into battle with vengeance on your mind. What you want to go into battle knowing that what you're doing is necessary, even though it's going to be gruesome and distasteful, but you don't want to go in loving it, because then you become like, if you start dehumanizing people, as he was talking about in that podcast, and I highly recommend people go listen to that, then you become like them, and you don't want to dehumanize your enemy, because then you become dehumanized yourself. You want to respect that other person's made in the likeness and image of God. But in this situation, because they have chosen to try and do evil toward innocent people or the interests of the United States, particularly they want to take out some of our innocent people, then we have the moral obligation to try and prevent them from doing that. And if that involves taking them out, if that's our only choice, that's what we do. We always know this. I mean, we know the rules of engagement. You use the least amount of force necessary to restore the peace. You use the least amount of force. You know, we were always told, you know, if you're in the Navy, you know, some guy shoots at you with a handgun, you don't drop a nuke on the guy, right? Okay. You just try and neutralize him. That's what you do. And that's what you're trying to do when you're involved in these missions. It's not something we want to do, but sometimes in a fallen world, it's the least worst choice you have.
Thanks, Frank. To go back to the beginning of our discussion, in order for all of this to actually come together, there has to be some type of truth. There has to be right or wrong, yes or no. So Frank, if somebody were to say, is there truth? Is there right or wrong? What would be your response to them?
Well, if someone ever says there's no truth, you're going to ask them, is that true? Because, you know, it's self-defeating to say there's no truth. you're uttering a truth claim there and claiming that it doesn't exist. It'd be like saying, I can't speak a word in English. You know, you go, wait a minute, man, you just used English to say that. So of course there's truth. The question is there moral truth? And I think it's self-evident there is. As I mentioned before, we all know torturing babies for fun is wrong. The question is, why is it wrong? Because there's a standard beyond us, and that standard is God's nature. And he has given this universe and us purpose, and he has also made us in the image of God. In fact, let's go back to your University of Arizona football days, right? If I were to ask you, Jason, how do you know that your quarterback throwing a touchdown is better than your quarterback throwing an interception? How would you know that that was a touchdown was better than an interception? What would you have to know in order to make that assessment?
Yeah, you'd have to know the rules of the game, definitely.
Yeah. And in fact, not just the rules, you'd have to know the purpose of the game, right? Like, what is the purpose of the game? If there's no purpose to the game, you can't say a touchdown better than an interception. But only because you know the purpose is to score more points than the other team, you know a touchdown for your side is better than your guy throwing an interception. Well, the same thing is true in life. If there's no purpose to life, you can't say anything's right or wrong. It would be just your opinion. Just like if there's no purpose to football game, you can't say that one play is a good play and the other play is a bad play. You got to know the purpose. So the question is, what's the purpose of life? And without God, there is no purpose to life. We're just molecular machines. We're just moist robots. And one day we're all going to die and the whole universe is going to go out of existence. We're going to go to heat death. So what's the purpose of anything we do if there's no God? But we know there is a purpose. The purpose is we're made in the image of God, and our purpose is to know him and to make him known. And sometimes there are people out there that don't know him, and they want to kill innocent people. And we, since they're made in the image of God, have to stop them. That's why we exist. Now, does this mean everything we do in the United States military is good and right and true? No. Maybe sometimes we get it wrong. And as you know, there's a code of conduct. We had it, of course, in the Navy when I was in 30 years ago. And we have a moral obligation to disobey an immoral order. We have a moral obligation to disobey an immoral, just like the Nazis had a moral obligation to disobey an immoral order to murder innocent people, which they did routinely, as you know. So there is a standard beyond us that we have to adhere to. If it's a choice between God and our government, we always choose God. Now, hopefully our government is aligned with God and is giving us moral orders. If it ever isn't, then we go, I can't do this, man. Sorry.
Thanks, Frank. And by the way, that is a great looking shirt you're wearing right there, sir.
That is, isn't it?
Oh,
send
yeah.
me, man. That's a SOCOM athlete shirt right there.
And for our listeners out there, our last episode with Matt Height, we also talk about John 15:13. No greater love is this than someone would lay down their life for their friends. And that seems to be when you talk to anybody about what they fought for when they were deployed, what they fought for in combat. They fought for their teammates.
That's next right. to them.
And that's
you ask any Medal of Honor winner that survives it. They say the number one reason that they did what they did was because they love their buddies. You know, yeah, of course they're there to protect the United States and protect the people of the United States. But when it really came down to it, Mansoor didn't jump on that grenade because of the flag. He jumped on that grenade because two guys were laying next to him. And if he didn't, they would have died.
Well said, Frank. And you see a fundamental difference between the American and our enemy is that our enemy is spiritually motivated to kill us and to kill innocents, and they will receive a reward for that in the afterlife. However, the American is to protect.
That's what our motive should be. Doesn't mean we always do it properly, but yeah, that's our motive right there. By the way, I want to point out one thing I didn't point out, because a lot of people will have questions about when Jesus says, turn the other cheek, you know. And I think when people are looking at Matthew chapter 5, which is the Beatitudes, the Sermon on the Mount, turn the other cheek was dealing with an individual insult. It was not talking about a government turning the other cheek. You know, if somebody insults you, you don't have to retaliate, okay? You can just take that on board and love the other person. You know, if they call you a name or something like that, okay, you don't have to retaliate by calling them a name. That's really what that's all about. But notice when Jesus was about to be crucified, they did slap him and he didn't turn the other cheek. He said, "Who slapped me?" Because he was blindfolded at the time. "Why did you do that?" Right? So Jesus is not talking about bodily harm. He's talking about an insult to individuals. Turn the other cheek would make no sense from a government perspective if the government is given the mission by God in Romans 13 to use the sword to protect innocent people from evil. The way the government protects innocent people from evil, if it's a capital crime, they may choose to execute the individual or lock that individual up to prevent that individual from harming other people. And also because that person is made in the likeness and image of God and needs to be treated like somebody who's morally responsible. So they're getting punishment for their crime. But imagine, you know, some murderer comes before a judge and he misinterprets the Sermon on the Mount. It says, love your enemies and turn the other cheek. He goes, this guy just murdered 10 people. I'm just going to turn the other cheek and let him go. No, that would be ridiculous, right? That's not justice. Those commands to turn the other cheek have nothing to do with either the justice system or the government using force as necessary to protect innocent people from evil. By the way, I wrote this thing is way back in 2008, but it's on our website at crossexamine.org. It's evergreen. It's not dated at all. The title of the piece is Jesus and the Case for War. Jesus and the Case for War, where I go through some of these objections people have about war and pacifism and all these things. And it's just a short article, maybe 1,000 words. If they go to crossexamine.org and go to the blog and go to the search engine and type in Jesus and the Case for War, they'll find it.
Thanks, Frank. And before we transition to live Q&A here with the SOCOM athlete students, can you tell our listeners out there a little bit more about CrossExamine, what you're doing with it in your book, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist?
Yeah, crossexamine.org, crossexamine with a D on the end of it, is a ministry where we go to colleges, high schools, and churches and present evidence that Christianity is true. And that evidence is found in our book, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. So we have a lot of video on our YouTube channel because we record everything we do on the college campus, including all the Q&A. And then we post the Q&A up on the YouTube channel. So there's probably 1,000 short videos that deal with questions that students on college campuses ask. And we try and keep the answers to anywhere between, say, 2 and 6 or so minutes. And so these videos are pretty short. And if they go to our YouTube channel, Cross-Examined, they can see all that. We also have TV on DirecTV, NRB channel. It's on Roku as well, National Religious Broadcasters. We have a podcast called I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. And we're on Instagram, all the places you are too, man. You know, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, what else? Twitter. Yeah.
So, and Frank,
we're out there.
Frank, best-selling author. I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. It's all in the title. How'd you come up with the title? And tell us a little bit more about it.
Yeah, well, actually, I didn't come up with the title. My co-author was Dr. Norman Geiser, who has written more books than most people have read. He died a couple of years ago, but when he died, they counted the number of books he either wrote or co-wrote or updated. It was 129. 129 books. Guy was 87 years old when he died. Anyway, I went to Southern Evangelical Seminary, ses.edu, for people interested in this kind of thing. And Dr. Geister and I were doing seminars around the country. And at the time, we were calling it the 12 points that show Christianity's true. We'd go through these 12 points and you'd start at does truth exist all the way to the Bible's the word of God. And I finally said to him, you know, Norm, this needs to be a book. And so we started writing the book. And at one point, at one of these seminars, he was going through the evidence that the universe is fine-tuned and that biology is designed. And the evidence for this is just overwhelming. There's got to be a designer out there. So he's going through all this evidence, Jason, and he gets to the end of it all. And you're just like, wow, this is amazing. And he finally said, look, in light of all this evidence, I don't have enough faith to be an atheist. And I went, that needs to be the title of the book. So we made it the title of the book. And when we put it out for proposal, one of the publishers said, we don't like the title. I said, what? You don't like the title? what do you want to call it? And they said, the truth about truth. I said, no way. That's a deal breaker, man. We don't go with this title. We're not doing it. And they finally said, okay, we'll keep the title. So I don't have enough faith to be an atheist. It's the title.
It's the perfect title, Frank. You're the man. Thank you so much for coming on with us tonight. For our listeners out there, this is Dr. Frank Turek, best-selling author, incredible friend, former naval aviator. Frank, what was your rank in the Navy when you got out?
I went through naval ROTC. So when I started as an O1 and got out as an O3, I was in for 8 years. Now I have two sons right now in the Air Force. And both of them, one's a major, and one of them's going to be a major select now. One's a pilot, the other guy's an intel guy in the Air Force. So that's your line of work, Air Force.
That's some military lineage right there, Frank. I bet you're a proud dad.
Oh, yeah, they're doing great. They're doing great. And my dad was in the Army. My wife's father was a test pilot in the Air Force, flew just about everything, served in Vietnam, and then went to Edwards and flew about everything that the Air Force had. And so a lot of military in our family.
Frank, before we close here, any verses or passages, books of the Bible that you recommend for warriors?
Well, Romans is really good. You can't not read the book of Romans and know that the military and police are necessary, particularly chapter 13. Okay, so Romans is something you definitely want to read. There's a book that I think, let me pull it off my shelf here, that if you had to read a book on this kind of topic, and it's not just about war and the military, this book by my co-author, Dr. Norman Geisler, is called Christian Ethics. Christian Ethics by Norman Geisler, G-E-I-S-L-E-R. And there's a whole chapter in here on war, which is very helpful. And it deals with some of the stuff we talked about and the fact that the military is necessary, properly used, just like the police are necessarily properly used. Doesn't mean that sometimes police officers don't do wrong or military people don't do wrong, but properly used, they're necessary because we live in a fallen world with fallen people. And if we don't have a military and we don't have police, we're going to have anarchy and a lot of innocent people dead.
Well said. And that's why we need the U.S. special operator more than ever these days.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for your time, Frank. Let's go ahead and transition.
Thanks, brother. You should be proud of what you've done and are doing and all the people out there that want to serve. It's very noble. And in fact, John the Baptist even said to the Roman centurion, he didn't say get out of the military. What he said, just treat people fairly and be content with your pay. So the military is necessary. Paul used the military to protect him when he was under pressure from the Jews. So it's necessary, needed, and so it's a very noble profession.
Well, thank you so much for your time again, Dr. Turek. Let's go ahead and transition a live Q&A with the students.
All right, let's do it.
All right, let's go ahead and get into our questions. Looks like our first question is from my man, Julian. Go ahead and ask your question.
Hey, Julian.
Hey, good evening, Dr. Turek. I just want to say first, thank you for your time. I know we all really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
But my question kind of has something to do with something that I ran into in college quite a bit with people. But really, it's what do you say to those who view Christianity as functionally useful for life in terms of its moral teachings, but not necessarily metaphysically true in terms of Jesus being raised from the dead and providing eternal life?
Well, I would ask them, why do you think it's not true? It is metaphysically useful. There's no question about that. Even some atheists are starting to admit that. Richard Dawkins, maybe the most famous atheist in the world, prefers Christianity to Islam for obvious reasons, right? And so does Douglas Murray, the guy that wrote Madness of the Crowds or Madness of Crowds. He's a functional atheist, but he says, hey, Christianity brings some good to society. But just because it brings good doesn't mean it's true. It could be false, right? The problem is, as Jason just mentioned, there is no good unless God exists. It would be just your opinion to say that, say, loving people is good and murdering them is bad. If there's no God, it would be just your opinion. So I would try and ask them, why don't they think Christianity is true? And then deal with the arguments that they come back at you with. Oh, I don't think there's any evidence for God. Okay, well, what do you mean by that? What evidence would there be for a God
What evidence would convince you? You know, that kind of thing. And I don't think anyone could rise from the dead. Well, how do you know that? Why are you saying that? What evidence do you have that says resurrections can occur? So I would just ask a lot of questions to figure out where they're coming from. But nothing can be metaphysically good unless God exists, because there is no good unless God exists. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
By the way, there's a lot more on our YouTube channel. So we're trying to keep answers short here. If you want to go more, you can check out our YouTube channel.
Yeah.
Frank, in fact, that entire presentation, Jason, that you and I were at together is on our YouTube channel, University of Arizona.
Yeah, Frank, I'll take a pause real quick and just show them. This is crossexamine.org, guys. And Frank is humble, so he won't tell you this. I'll let you guys know. Frank is the godfather of apologetics. And if you don't know what apologetics is, this is essentially the defense of Christian faith through evidence. And not just evidence, but we're talking philosophy, theology, science, history. And Frank is really the cornerstone of this right now. And God has done a lot of great things through him. So this is his website. His Instagram is huge. His YouTube channel is huge. He's got millions of views on some of his videos, and he really tackles these tough questions. So check out Dr. Turek. He's a phenomenal resource. I listen to all of his podcasts. It's a great resource as well. Okay, next one. Let's go ahead and go with Cordell, actually. Sorry, Cordell. I got to call you out, man. Finished our Hell Day recently. He became a follower of Jesus Christ after Hell Day. He's especially excited to meet you tonight, Frank.
Go ahead, Cordell.
Yeah, Cordell, what's up, dude?
So my question is, if we're created in God's image, why is it that we're so easily swayed to be inherently bad?
Okay, good question. When it says God's image, what that means is we don't look like God because he's an immaterial being. It means we're person like God, that we have mind, emotion, and will, that we think, we feel, we want. We can make moral choices. God makes moral choices. We can make moral choices. We're the only being we know about that has the capacity to make moral choices. You know, a dog doesn't make moral choices. A giraffe doesn't make moral choices, but human beings do. We think about higher things like, is there a God? What's my purpose in life? That kind of thing. And why are we bent toward evil? Well, we made a choice. God gave us a choice in the garden to follow him or not follow him. And a lot of people will say, well, gee, why did God, knowing what we would do, give us a choice? Why did he put the tree in the garden and the snake and all that? Or really Satan disguised as a serpent. Because in order for this to be a moral universe, he has to give us free choice. If we don't have free choice, we can't love. We would just be moist robots, okay? If we don't have free will, we can't love. Of course, if we have free will, then we can love, but we can also hate. We can do evil. So God gave us a choice because he wanted a moral universe, a place where people could make real choices. So he gave us the real choice to follow him or not. Now, we chose not to follow him. We chose to rebel. And that tainted our nature in the sense that we're bent toward evil. This is sometimes called depravity. And what depravity means, according to the great historical Christian scholar Augustine, he said depravity is the propensity to sin and the necessity to die. Depravity means that we're bent towards sin, that it's easier to be bad than it is to be good. As I mentioned earlier, right? It's easy to be bad. It's easy to do bad things. It's hard to do good things. You have to deny yourself to do good things. You don't have to teach a kid to say mine. The kid already knows that, right? You have to teach the kid to share, because the kid is bent toward evil like the rest of us. So we're bent in that way because of our sin, but God has provided us a way out. He came as the perfect sacrifice. He never sinned. He didn't have the sin nature. He came to earth, lived the perfect life in our place. And then by trusting in him, we can not only be forgiven for what we've done, but we can be given his righteousness. So Christianity is a free gift. You don't do anything, because there's nothing you can do to earn your salvation. You're just given what he's already provided. So you don't achieve your identity in Christianity. You receive your identity in Christianity. You receive it. It's easy. You just take it. Now, as a result of what God has done for us, what Christ has done for us, we, out of gratitude for what he's done, live a life that's pleasing to him, a life that is attractive to other people to bring them into the kingdom. So that's why we stay away from sin. because it's out of gratitude and love for God as to what he's done for us that we become his ambassador. We become someone who can bring other people into the kingdom as we grow in Christ ourselves. So we're bent toward evil because we made a free choice. And God, though, has provided the way out. Does that make sense, Cordell?
Yeah, that makes sense. But besides pleasing God, what are the other, I guess, motivations that we have for abstaining from sin?
Well, besides pleasing God, abstaining from sin also benefits you as an individual, because sin is good in the short term, but it's terrible over the long term. Okay, that's the problem with it. It looks good right away. It may pay off immediately, but over the long term, it's a disaster. And the older you get, the more you realize this, right? That's why the proverb spends so much time on keeping your heart free from sin. In fact, probably one of the most important proverbs is Proverbs 4:23, where it says, above all else, guard your heart, because everything you do flows from it. Notice it doesn't say above all else, follow your heart. That's what the culture says. God says, guard your heart. Why? Because there's so many temptations out there, and the main temptations are in three categories. In fact, my friend Jim Wallace is a cold case homicide detective in Los Angeles. He's been on Dateline more than any other homicide detective because he solved murders that are decades old. And he says whenever he finds a murdered body, he says he knows there's only three reasons why that guy's dead. It's not 1,000 reasons. There's just three, or one of three, or a combination of the three. There was either a sex issue, a money issue, or a power issue. Sex, money, and power. Those are the three things that cause us to sin. Now, sex, money, and power are good things, but they're so good that sometimes we will take shortcuts to get them. We will do evil to get them. And that's why the Proverbs in particular, and so does the New Testament, they spend a lot of time talking about sex, money, and power, because sex, money, and power are Achilles' heel. They can get us into trouble big time. Now, they're good things. Again, the problem is if we take shortcuts to get them, that's where they're going to cause trouble, not only to us, but to others. So not only do we try and please God, but we actually help ourselves when we follow his laws. And let me put it this way. A lot of people are upset that God gives us certain things to do and not do. Let me ask you guys a question. If you buy a new car and you read the manual and the manual says, do these things and don't do these things if you want to keep your car in good running order and you don't want to hurt yourself, do we get mad at Ford or Hyundai or whoever makes the car because they told us don't do these things and do these other things? No, we don't get mad at them. We go, hey, thanks, man. That'll help me, right? Why do we get mad at God when he does the same thing? He says, hey, here's the manual. Here's how you ought to live. And we get mad when we can't do this and we can't do that. Well, those are like guardrails. God's laws are guardrails. We think they're going to cramp our fun. No, they're guardrails so we can live a more full life. I mean, you can drive down the highway and get to where you're going if you stay between the lines, right? But you start going outside the lines, you start going in the shoulder, you start going in the median, you're going through the woods, you know, you're not going to make it to where you're going. Any freedom requires restraint. You don't have restraint in a fallen world, you're not going to make it. In fact, none of us would be alive right now if we followed our heart everywhere, if we followed our desires everywhere. You'd be dead. I'd be dead already. If I don't obey certain restraints, I'm going to kill myself and others. That's why the guardrails are there. That's why the commands are there.
Thanks, Frank. As we get going here, the primary reason that I had Frank on today, besides the fact that he's great at pull-ups and he's a good friend, is the fact that Frank is essentially doing special ops ministry. Frank is going to the front lines at these universities, such as University of Arizona, which is where we met, where being a Christian is not a widely accepted thing, okay? And he goes and he gives his presentation and he allows everybody to line up and have at it. Now, whether it's they ask good questions or whether they ask hostile questions as an atheist, Frank opens up the floor and he puts himself out there. And for those of you guys that have done anything like that, any type of ministry where you put yourself out there in front of a hostile crowd, It is not a comfortable place to be. So you guys here at the Hell Days, and obviously getting ready for special operations, you hear the phrase, get comfortable being uncomfortable. And you hear things like the PJ motto, these things we do that others may live, sacrificing personal desires and comforts, right? All of these things Frank does. I look up to him very much for that. And the next thing I wanted to talk to you guys about is, for those of you guys that are in the military now, you may be aware, for those that aren't in the military now, we have chaplains in the military. All four branches have chaplains. And the United States military presupposes a Christian worldview. And that's why we have Christian chaplains. And like Frank said, it's in the Declaration of Independence. The military doesn't require people to be Christians. It is there on our currency, the US dollar, right there, in God we trust. So we do have something very special here in the United States of America. We have a tradition of Christianity. Our military supports it. Frank, I wanted to, obviously you and I talked about it on the interview, but I wanted to kind of reopen the discussion a little bit so these guys can hear. The question comes so often to us at SOCOM Athlete as guys pursue career fields like being a Green Beret or combat controller or a SEAL or a recon Marine or whatever the job may be. These are combat jobs, right? You could join the military and check IDs at a fitness center or essentially cook food. These aren't necessarily combat jobs, right? So Frank, how do you serve God? How do you be a Christian and be a warrior at the same time? Join the military.
Yes, because the Bible does not say thou shalt not kill. It says thou shalt not murder. There's a difference. There is just killing in a number of circumstances. For example, self-defense. It's just to defend yourself. Also, in a just war where you have two legitimate governments fighting one another, that is legitimate as well. So, or in capital punishment, when the government has been given the authority by God to mete out capital crimes or to mete out punishment for capital crimes. So there are at least three instances where killing is actually permitted. And I would even argue that it's your duty on certain occasions to take a life if that life is going to, in some way, take the innocent life of someone else. If that's the only way to prevent the death, that's what you do. So it's a noble thing to actually be a part of the United States military or the United States police force, because those are the two professions that are necessary for any other profession to exist. If you don't have security at home inside the borders, that's what police take care of. You can't have any other business, not any other business that will last, because if there's no security, there's no business that can survive long term. And if you don't have security outside the borders, if the nation isn't secure, then everything inside the nation isn't secure either. So if you think about any other profession requires security. It requires a military. It requires a police force. And it doesn't mean that everything the cops or the military does is always good. Sometimes we make mistakes. Sometimes we do wrong things, just like any other profession. But it is a noble profession precisely because there's evil out there, and evil needs to be suppressed or destroyed if it rears its ugly head, because you can't do anything else if somebody kills you or if somebody takes away your right to actually exist or to conduct business. So the military and the police are necessary. And even the Bible talks about this. If you look at Romans chapter 13, which is Paul's letter to the Romans, he says that the ruler does not bear the sword for nothing. And that was a way of saying the ruler has the authority to execute punishment on the wrongdoer. That's necessary. In fact, it was James Madison, one of our founding fathers, who said, if men were angels, no government would be necessary. Think about that. If we were inherently good and we never did evil, would you need a government? No. The reason you need a government, it's because people are bent toward evil. It's much easier to be bad than good. It's much easier to steal something than to work for it. It's much easier to shoot somebody if you could rather than compete against them, right? And so if we don't have a government that is designed to protect innocent people from evil, then nothing else matters. So what you're doing is noble and right and true. And that's why, by the way, we have a code of conduct in the military, right? You're only supposed to carry out moral orders. You're not supposed to carry out immoral orders. If someone gives you an immoral order, you don't carry it out. But if it's a moral order, you carry it out. And most of the time, it will be a moral order. This is why, by the way, the Nazis couldn't hide behind, well, we were just following our government. There's a standard beyond all governments. It's international law. It's called the moral law. And it's really God's nature. That's why we could say the Allies were right in World War II and the Nazis weren't, because there's a standard beyond both the Nazi regime and the Allied regime. That standard is God's nature. So we're supposed to actually support the truth, support what's right. We're not supposed to do what's wrong. That's why there's a code of conduct.
Well said, Frank. And that moral law can't exist unless there's a God.
That's right.
Because if there's not a God, then there can't be good and there can't be evil. There is no standard by which good and evil can be judged. And thank goodness that we live in the United States of America and can serve in this military where we can continue to enforce good over evil. Thank you for that, Frank. All right, guys, let's go ahead and go on to the next question. Looks like we got Christian. Go ahead, my man.
Hey, how's it going? So my question has a little bit to do with justifying my belief in God, but I need to give a little bit of context to where I'm coming from. So I was born and raised here in Tucson, Arizona. You know, my family, though, is from Mexico. So I have, you know, Mexican blood runs in my veins. Proud to be an American. I'm also proud of being Mexican. I ended up going to college in Iowa, and there's a really big difference in population from Arizona and Iowa. When I was in college, I started to question a little bit and try to find out, like, okay, why is my name Christian? Why do I believe in Christianity? Why am I Catholic? And I started digging deeper. I realized, you know, in Mexican history, the way that I came about being Catholic, or the way that the faith ended up coming to these lands, ended up being, for the most part throughout history, violently, through rape, pillaging, you know, the great conquistadores that came over from Spain. And it just really, in my heart, it just kind of, I grew up Catholic. I just have a very hard time justifying my belief in the faith, knowing that it came to that land, to those people, through a violent manner for the most part. So how would I justify, I guess, advice on how I can maneuver that situation of being proud of being Mexican, but also knowing the fact that the Catholic faith came to the Americas through a violent fashion.
Okay, well, first of all, let me ask you this question, Christian. If somebody plays Beethoven poorly, who do you blame? Beethoven or the guy trying to play Beethoven?
The guy trying to play Beethoven.
Okay, so if somebody claims to be a Christian and doesn't follow Christ, who do you blame?
The one who claims to be a Christian.
Yeah, you're not blaming Christ, you're not blaming God. And so there's been a lot of negative behavior in Christian history. There's no question about that. But that doesn't mean that Christianity is not true. That doesn't mean that there's no God. In fact, as we talked about earlier, the only way any, say, rape or murder or any of that could be wrong is if God existed. Otherwise, everything's just a matter of opinion. Okay, so there's a lot of bad things that go on in Christian history, but the only way we know they're bad or could be bad is if God existed. Now, I don't know if I would agree that the Mexican population was brought Catholicism by a bunch of rapists, because there were a lot of missions. That's what missions are. They came from Spain to bring Christianity to the Mexican continent or the Mexican nation. And I don't know all the odds and ends of the history there, but just because there were some bad people doesn't mean there weren't a lot of good people who had good intentions. But again, whether they have good intentions, bad intentions, good behavior, bad behavior, that doesn't tell you a thing about whether or not the view is true, right? Just like somebody who plays Beethoven poorly doesn't necessarily reflect on Beethoven himself. I think that Christianity is true because you can show it through evidence. You can show that truth exists. You can show that God exists. You can show miracles are possible, and you can show that Jesus rose from the dead. That's our outline when we go to college campuses. We talk about truth, God, miracles, and the New Testament, the resurrection. If those four things are true, that there is truth, there is a God, there are miracles, and Jesus rose from the dead, then Christianity is true. Whether or not people who claim to be Christians have acted that way appropriately all the time, morally all the time, that's another question. It doesn't affect whether or not Christianity is true. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And where would you suggest for someone who wants to dive deeper into like their faith in, you know, Christianity, where do we start? If we don't want to just go about it just because we were raised that way.
Right. Good. Well, if you want to know if it's true, we did write a book that people have found helpful. It's called I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. It argues from the ground up that Christianity is true, all the way from people who say, I don't even believe in truth, to the fact that the Bible is the word of God. So if you want to check that out, you can also, I mean, that's the detailed version. If you want to see a shorter a presentation of it, then you can go to our YouTube channel and you can look at the presentation I did at University of Arizona with Jason was there about a year and a half or two ago. And there's many other presentations you can see on our YouTube channel.
It's a phenomenal book, Christian. It's a phenomenal book. It's loaded with resources. I mean, he hits resource after resource, evidence after evidence, and it's a lot to extract.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, if you want to get an overview, a visual overview, you can, but there's a lot left out, obviously, in a visual presentation. Just go to the Cross-Examined YouTube channel and search for a college event. They'll usually be between 2 and 3 hours, you know, including Q&A.
Awesome. That'd be great. Right. Thank you. Thank you for your answer.
Yeah. Thanks, Christian.
All right. Let's go on to the next. Harden, did you get your microphone working, bud?
Yeah.
Harden, you're lagging again, bud.
I can read it. I can see it. He wrote it in the chat.
Okay.
He said he answered the question about the fifth commandment. But I also have a question about other religions and why does God let there be so many other religions when he wants everyone to follow him? Well, because God allows free will and free will is the only way that love could exist. It would be like saying, how could a man provide a woman with a number of choices of who to marry if he's the only man on earth? The woman would, if she wanted to get married, there's only one guy to marry, right? Okay. But she doesn't really have a choice then, does she? If she wants to get married, she's got to marry this guy. But if there are a number of choices out there, then true love can occur because she can choose you over these other guys because you're true, you're right, and these other guys aren't right for her. Now, it's not a perfect analogy because marriage can obviously be a matter of preference. But when it comes to Christianity is true, I think. I think you can show it's true. And wherever non-Christian worldviews disagree with Christianity, they would be false. I'm not saying everything taught by other world religions is false. Just about every religion has some truth in it. But where it differs from Christian world, the Christian belief system, if Christianity is true, it has to be false. Like, for example, Islam gets things right. They believe in God, right? They believe that we ought to pray. They believe we ought to give to the poor. Those are all true things, okay? But what it mainly gets wrong is who Jesus was. Islam doesn't believe Jesus was God. Islam doesn't even believe Jesus died, much less rose from the dead. So there's a problem there. And as you know, Islam came along over 600 years after Christianity. And the Muslims are trying to tell us they know what happened to Jesus 600 years later, when in fact the eyewitnesses who were with Jesus knew what happened to Jesus. He died and rose again. So any worldview that differs from the truth by definition has to be false. And if Christianity is the truth, then any worldview that differs from Christianity has to be false in those areas.
Awesome. Thank you, Dr. Turek. Harden, I see you nodding. I think he answered your question pretty well. Great answer. Okay, next question. Let's go ahead and go with Nathan. Go ahead and come off mute, ask your question, bud.
Hey, Frank, I really appreciate you being here with us tonight. And sure. I actually watched your YouTube channel even before I found out that you were going to be on here with us with the Q&A. And I can't tell you, Brent, when I saw you were going to be on here, because I've been skimming through your channel recently, actually, you know, kind of finding myself again through your channel. Appreciate it. And I appreciate your service as well in the military and to the Lord.
Thank you.
I've got a couple questions tonight. I'll answer one and maybe you can bounce back to me later. But first question I have is about evolution and the the relationship between monkeys and us. And, you know, because science can tell us that the DNA is very similar and even just our characteristics in general, I'm kind of where I'm confused is how our, I know we were created by God, but what would be the reason behind the DNA being similar and the characteristics being similar? I'm kind of lost there.
All right, let me ask you a question. Why do most cars have four tires?
Because that's how they operate, I guess. That's the most efficient way for them to work.
To design. They were designed that way, right? Because there's a standard design that seems to work best in most cases. You know, some vehicles have more tires, but most of them have four. Because, not because they have a common ancestor, but because they have a common designer. Now, the argument that many evolutionists give is they're trying to say that homology, which is similarity of structure, must show that, or homology, similarity of structure, or DNA, similarity of the biological code. They're trying to say that because the codes are similar, that they must come from an ancestral source, a common ancestor. That's a possible interpretation. What's the other possible interpretation?
That they were just created to be similar?
Yeah, they have a common design because the code works best for primates, the kind of code that we have, just like four tires work best for a private vehicle, okay? And so you would need evidence outside of homology and outside of DNA to say, well, the pendulum points more toward evolution than it does, say, intelligent design. And I think when you look at the evidence points much more strongly toward intelligent design than it does evolution. In fact, a code, where do codes come from? They come from coders, right? Whenever I see a software program, I know there's got to be a programmer. The DNA code itself requires intelligence. You don't get codes by random processes. You get codes by programmers. This is why Bill Gates, who, as you know, is no Christian, said DNA is like a software program, but it's far, far more complex than anything we've ever created as human beings. Okay? So the code itself should tip it off. That's why my friend Stephen Meyer wrote the book Signature in the Cell, because the DNA genome, the code that's in every one of us, or the genome in every one of us, is 3.2 billion letters long. All the data is in the right order. All the letters are in the right order. That's like a software program where all the letters are in the right order. If you change the order of the letters, the program crashes. It doesn't work. Same thing is true when it comes to human beings and other living things. The code was put there by a coder. Now, we've got chapters in our book on this, but let me just say this. Even if macroevolution is true, which it isn't, but even if it was, it wouldn't get rid of the need for God. Why? You still need somebody to create the universe, fine-tune the universe, create the first life. You need somebody who's the ground of morality, the ground of natural law, the ground of consciousness, the ground of the evidence we see for reason and the evidence we see for Old Testament prophecy and the resurrection of Jesus. Evolution doesn't explain any of those things. If evolution explains anything, it explains a very small part of life, and that is, where does subsequent life forms come from? That's what it's trying to explain. Well, there's so much more to explain than subsequent life forms. Before you can get to life, you need a universe, right? Where'd the universe come from? Why is it fine-tuned? Where do the natural laws that drive evolution come from, if evolution is true? Now, evolution is true in the certain sense, what's called microevolution, that we can adapt to our environment. Yeah. But macroevolution, molecules to man without intelligence? No, there's no evidence for that. I think there's evidence against that.
Yep. I had another question, kind of childish. Dinosaurs, does the Bible mention, I haven't read the Bible end to end, so I don't know. But does it mention dinosaurs? Well,
first of all, the word dinosaur wasn't created until a couple of centuries ago. So no, the word's not going to be in there. Secondly, the Bible does mention the land animals. And it does mention behemoth. And some say in the book of Job, that could be a dinosaur, right? Okay. But the Bible doesn't mention giraffes either. The Bible doesn't specifically mention hyenas. The Bible doesn't specifically mention elk, right? Because it's not a book on taxonomy. It's a book that's, the purpose of the book is to make you wise unto salvation. That's from 2 Timothy 3. It's not to tell you everything about everything. No book could. In fact, when people say, why doesn't the Bible mention the dinosaurs? I say for the same reason it doesn't mention the pyramids or the Great Wall of China, because that's not the scope of the document. The scope of the document is to make you wise into salvation. It's not to tell you everything about everything. In fact, no book could. What authors have to do, well, I'm writing a book with my son right now, you have to leave out a lot more than you can put in. It's what you leave out. You have to say, I don't have time for this. I can't tell you all about it. That's not the purpose of why I'm writing. You leave out a lot more than you put in any book, including the Bible.
And I've got one more question here, and I've got more, and I know there's other people in line behind me, so hopefully you can bounce me back to me later. But I had a question recently. This one came up within the past couple of weeks about Noah's Ark.
Mm-hmm.
I saw a video of a skeptic talking about, you know, just the dimensions that the Bible gives of the Ark and how many animals were on the Ark. And he did some math and said, you know, there would have to be X amount of food and there's be X amount of animals and given the dimension. So what would your response to that be? I mean, just the sheer magnitude of the amount of animals that would have to be on the ark and the food, you know, is there some missing details in there that, you know, you understand what I'm saying?
Sure. Well, I don't know what his calculations were because other people have done calculations and said there was plenty of room. So who knows? Yeah. Others argue over whether the flood was worldwide or a local flood in the known populated area. Do you know that virtually every ancient culture has a flood story? They all have a great flood story. Now, you might ask yourself, why? Because there was a great flood. That's why. Okay. Now, they have different accounts of how it occurred, but everybody agrees there was a great flood story. And the reason I believe Noah's Ark is historical is because Jesus seemed to, right? Jesus related his own life to Noah and Jonah, two of the most controversial miracles in the Old Testament. But Noah and Jonah are easy miracles. Why? Because what's the greatest miracle in the Bible? The greatest miracle in the Bible is the first verse. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. If that verse is true, every other verse is at least possible. And now you have atheists admitting the data for the first verse. What do I mean? Even Stephen Hawking, the great physicist, atheist, said, almost everyone now believes that the universe and time itself had a beginning at the Big Bang. Now, Hawking tried to come up with another explanation other than God. He failed at that, but he's admitting the data. What's the data? That space, time, and matter literally had a beginning. Well, if space, time, and matter literally had a beginning, what could have caused that? The only thing that could have caused it is something spaceless, timeless, immaterial, powerful to create the universe out of nothing, personal in order to choose to create, because to go from nothing to a state of creation, someone had to make a choice and only persons make choices. The being would also have to be intelligent to have a mind to make a choice. And so I always ask people, when you think about a spaceless, timeless, immaterial, powerful, personal, intelligent cause, who do you think of? That's what we mean by God. Now, we don't know it's the Christian God from just that argument. This is called the cosmological argument for the beginning of the universe, that there had to be a beginner. We don't know it's the Christian God, but once we realize that Jesus rose from the dead, then we can conclude that the same being that walked out of the tomb 1,988 years ago is the same being in whose divine nature created the universe out of nothing. So if Genesis 1:1 is true, and the atheists are admitting the data for Genesis 1:1, then Noah, Jonah, resurrections, walking on water, parting the Red Sea. This is easy. Easy for God to create the universe out of nothing.
Nathan, great questions. We're going to move on to somebody else. I had a quick caveat on something that Dr. Turek said about evolution. When it comes down to evolution, Nathan, by definition, okay, let's say that we have a Petri dish. And in that Petri dish, we have a population of bacteria. And we drop antibiotics into that population of bacteria. And let's just say that there's 800 billion bacteria particles in there, okay, organisms, right? We got them all in there, all right? And let's say that 20,000 of those bacteria have some type of resistance in their genetic code to the antibiotics, all right? So they're still alive, but all the rest of the bacteria is dead. So those 20,000 bacteria, they repopulate, 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 and they make a new colony that is now resistant to that antibiotic that wiped out the population earlier. Now, that new colony, all right, as long as they cannot reproduce, all right, with the old type of bacteria in there, they by definition have evolved. Okay, you have a new population, all right, that is resistant, all right, they can't reproduce with the old, they've evolved, but they're still bacteria. So when you bring up from monkey to man, that by definition, Frank is talking macroevolution, because as somebody who graduated from the University of Arizona, you'll never hear the term macroevolution and microevolution in a school like that. You won't hear it. Christians will say it, but you won't hear it from the professor. Why? Because it's all evolution to them. So by definition, evolution, God created that. But where there's problems is like what Frank said, you know, saying that the lungfish is what's responsible for transition of water-based animals into land from an animal flopping around for millions of years and mistakenly sprouting a lung because of a mutation really had no cause. So really the issue is the Darwinian evolution that's being taught. And that is the common ancestor, that we all come from one common ancestor, where clearly the Bible states that species were created individually. It says it right there in Genesis.
This is what Jason's degree was in, by the way, just so you know, at University of Arizona. So he's dialed in on this. By the way, just so you know, if you talk to an evolutionist, they don't believe that man came from monkeys. What they believe is there's a common ancestor that monkeys and man have had. Okay, that's their belief. So just to be precise, if you're talking to an evolutionist.
Nathan, understand the terms that are going to be thrown at you in college. This doesn't disprove God. It doesn't disprove his creation. Okay, it's all in the terminology. It's all in the name. All right, let's go ahead and go on to our next question. Looks like we got Cordell. We'll come back to you since you already asked a question. Let's go with Aiden next.
Hello. I just want to first say thank you for taking the time and coming on here. And my question is kind of going back to what we first talked about in the beginning of the meeting with dealing with being in the military and having to take or possibly having to take someone else's life. And my question is, as a Christian and stuff like that, how do you kind of not necessarily prepare, but how do you kind of get yourself right with God, knowing that you may be called upon to that, like there may be a moment where you have to decide to take someone's life or to let them live and like that. And how do you kind of get yourself right with God, knowing that you may have to do this?
Well, I think you're already right with God as soon as you accept what Christ has done for you. You accept the free gift. So your sins are forgiven. So if that's what you mean, anyone can do that, whether you're in the military or not, and everyone ought to do that. But I think further, you ought to be able to think about these things before they happen. My co-author, Dr. Geiser, wrote a book called Christian Ethics. And in there, he has a whole chapter on war and what are the ethics of war? What is just war theory? What is that all about? So if you want to, and you probably should want to do this before you actually get into that kind of situation, is read that chapter in there on Christian ethics by Geisler, Geisler. That would be helpful. All right.
Thank you.
The whole book is good. I mean, I'm just calling out that one chapter because that's the issue that you're asking about.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Aiden.
Good to see you again, Aiden. You still sore from the hell day or what?
I'm doing good. I was able to use the running techniques and get my run times down. So I'm doing good.
Good.
Yes, sir. Good, man.
I'm glad you had a good time. Tough hell day. Yes. You survived.
Yes, sir. It was a lot of fun. A lot of fun and a lot of hard work.
I'm glad you had a good time, my man. All right. Let's go ahead and go on to our next question. Mr. John, how are you, brother?
Good. How are you doing, Jason?
Doing great, man. Good to see you. What's your question, bud?
So first I just want to say, to Dr. Turek, I struggled with my faith, really bad in high school, and I ended up finding your book, and it really, I think at one point I was calling myself an atheist, And I really turned myself back to Christ. And I was really looking for that type of argument instead of just believe it because you're at church. Don't embarrass us. Don't ask questions like that. So I just want to say thank you.
Oh, yeah. Good. Yeah. Yeah, if you're at a church and someone says, don't ask questions, you're at the wrong church, man.
Yeah.
Come, let us reason together, says the Lord. Always ready to give an answer for the hope that you have. So, yeah, get answers wherever you go.
Absolutely. So my question is, from just my understanding is that within like all of human history, everyone has had the general revelation that, you know, a superior creator being exists, but yeah. It has only been within the past 200 years where atheism has really ignited and has become, you know, like 30% of like United States' religion is no religion or something like that. Why do you think it's been, you know, that 200 years has had the spark that once before it was everyone, you know, knew there was a God. It just depended on who he was. But now it's there's no God.
Well, I think part of it has to do with the fact that this has really been a more of a rebellion than a decision to look at evidence and follow the evidence where it leads. Obviously, prior to the founding of the United States of America, religion and the state were very much mixed. You know, you had the Church of England, and that's where our founding fathers came from, and they didn't want to have a national church in America. They just wanted to have freedom of religion, not freedom from religion. And they wanted everybody to make their own choices. The states could have state churches. In fact, 5 of the 13 colonies, when they signed the Constitution, had their own state churches. So they didn't think the state couldn't have a church, but they didn't want the federal government to have a church or to have any sort of religious test for office. The states could do that, but not the feds. Now, what has happened over the years, the real problem, I think, since then, has really been the church not acting as the church. One of the reasons that the culture is where it is now in America anyway, is because about 100 years ago, the church went anti-intellectual. In other words, instead of engaging the culture and answering things like Darwinism, they didn't think they could do it in the 1920s, they circled the wagons and they separated from the culture. And they said, there's only two professions that are really godly professions. You can either be a pastor or a missionary. Everything else is secular. Well, that's not the Christian worldview. The Christian worldview is every moral profession is sacred. And the Christian is supposed to be a Christian in all of society, not just in church on Sunday. Okay. And instead of then engaging the culture, what happened was the church turned inward and segregated itself from the culture. They didn't get involved in the media. They didn't get involved as much in education anymore. They didn't get involved in politics or law or any of these things. And then what happened was the secularists took over those areas and they started training all of the attorneys who ultimately rose to the Supreme Court, who early in the 1960s began throwing God and the Bible out of society by judicial fiat. So what happened was, is the church really, instead of engaging the culture, withdrew from the culture. And that's why the culture has gone godless. When you take the godly people out of the culture and say, don't get involved, stay over here, is it any wonder the culture goes godless? So it's really the church's fault. If you go to our website, crossexamine.org, you'll click on the search engine, type in country a mess, blame the church. I wrote a column, this goes all the way back to 2009, but I could have written it yesterday. It explains what happened. It's really our fault in America anyway, that the church or that many people now say they're apathetic or they don't care, or they're atheists. The church hasn't been the church. So it's more our fault than anybody else.
Sweet. Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
All right. Thanks, John. Again, because people believe it or don't believe it doesn't make it true or false. The evidence will tell you whether it's true or false. So don't concern yourself with seeing so many people falling away from the faith and you going, oh, maybe it isn't true. No, it's true regardless of what people think about it, right? You've got to look at the evidence to see whether it's true or not.
And there's usually a motive behind that, John. So for example, Charles Darwin, he was a Catholic, and then he lost his daughter when she was very, very young. And I'm not saying that he wasn't already studying that information when he lost his daughter, but when he lost his daughter, he went out on a warpath to come up with a justification that there was no reason that that happened and that it just happened. So at the end of the day, if there is evidence that would destroy the theory of evolution, okay, people don't want that to happen. Okay, so the endosymbiont hypothesis, something that I studied in biochemistry 496, there's a couple transmembrane proteins that are responsible for the thermodynamics of the endosymbiont hypothesis for it to be true. And these proteins were discovered in 2002. All right, the inventor of this theory, Lynn Margulis, all right, I think she passed away in like 1960, or she came up with the theory in like 1960. Okay, she passed away before these proteins were discovered. So thermodynamically, there's an equation for how this could happen. And what Fazali Rana, who I brought up early, brings up is that this mathematically could not happen. However, the schools don't want to teach that because then they would have to essentially mitigate this and then mitigate that and then have an answer for this and have an answer for that. And to me, in my opinion, evolution, macroevolution, if we want to call it that, is a parachute. And if some of the lines break on that parachute, the whole parachute goes down. But to go back on Noah's Ark, what you were talking about earlier, in my opinion, people try to pick on Noah's Ark because they're looking for that big error in the Bible. And if they find that error in the Bible, then they can say in their mind that the whole Bible isn't true. Because there's one error, then the whole Bible isn't true. Well, guess what? Because the Bible was made up of individual sources and compiled from individual sources, even if there was an error, it doesn't make the entire Bible untrue. Right. So at the end of the day, you have to realize that people have a motive for this. Okay. And at the end of the day, if evolution is proven untrue, what would we do at our universities? And remember, science, okay, science is how we interpret the world around us, natural world around us, through experimentation. So science is only as good as we interpret it to be. All right.
Let me mention one question you can ask people that gets right to the heart of what Jason's saying. It's a question I ask of atheists on college campuses. If they get up to the Q&A microphone and they express any hostility at all, I normally ask them this question. The question is, if Christianity were true, would you become a Christian? Now, I've had atheists stand at the microphone in front of hundreds of people and say, no. And I'll say, no. Wait, I thought you claimed to be reasonable. How is it reasonable to not believe something that's true? Well, it's not. The problem isn't in the head. The problem's in the heart. They don't want it to be true. They don't want there to be a God. Why? Because if God exists, then they can't do whatever they want in their lives. You see, they don't want there to be God because they want to be God, God of their own lives. They're not on a truth quest. They're on a happiness quest. And they're just going to believe whatever they think is going to make them happy. And they think having moral autonomy, being able to do whatever I want to do, whenever I want to do it, with whomever I want to do it, is the way to happiness. And God is putting guardrails on me, and I don't want those guardrails. And even some evolutionists have admitted this, that that's why they believe in macroevolution, because they think if there is no creator, again, it doesn't get rid of the need for a creator, but somehow they think it does. If there's no creator, then they can sleep with whomever they want to sleep with. In fact, some have even admitted that. It has much more to do with morality than it has to do with evidence for the view.
Thanks, Frank. Powerful stuff. And again, if there is no God, then we cannot determine if something is good or evil. Mm-hmm. Which comes back to our original topic of, can I be a Christian and be a warrior in the military? Well, yes, we are founded on good. That's what this nation is all about. Okay, we got time for two more questions, guys. We'll circle back to Cordell, and then we'll hit Harden. Hopefully, you have fixed your connectivity issues, my man. Otherwise, just type your question, Harden. All right, let's go ahead and go back to Cordell.
I was wondering, how do you deal with Bible verses that seem to contradict each other, or ones that give out things that wouldn't necessarily be fly today, I guess.
Mike, you got to give me an example, because otherwise we don't know if it's contradictory and what, like, what would be an example?
So I have one here that says Proverbs 24:17. Rejoice not when thine enemy falleth, and let not thine heart be glad when he stumbleth. But then we have Psalms 58:10. It says, the righteous shall rejoice when he seeketh the vengeance. I think I wrote that down wrong. He shall wash his feet in the blood of the wicked.
Okay, well, first of all, you got to remember that Proverbs, for most of the Bible is God talking to us through people. Most of the Psalms are us talking to God, okay? So Psalms are many times they're prayers, okay? And the psalmist may be expressing his emotion or his feelings. When he sees the unrighteous fail, he goes, yay, justice is done. But yet God is saying in the proverb, read it again. What does it say again, Cordo?
Rejoice not when thine enemy falleth, and let not thine heart be glad when he stumbleth.
Yes. So that's the kind of heart we ought to have, because we're praying for our enemies, which is an unheard of ethic in any other system. By the way, this is one reason why we know love is not a feeling, because you can't feel good about your enemies, right? You don't feel good about your enemies. Love is a decision to seek what's best for them. So just because you have the proverb saying, okay, here's God saying, don't do this, but someone in the psalm saying, wow, I really rejoice when I see my evil foe fall, they're just expressing two different expressions. One is God speaking to us. Us is us saying back to God, hey, good, justice has occurred. Now, we don't want to ask for justice, because if everyone got justice, we'd all be toast right now, okay? If none of us are completely just, right? We're unjust, unjust people. That's why we need a savior. So if we're asking God to judge other people, be careful, because he might judge us. You ever notice when we start complaining about the problem of evil, we always say, hey, God, why don't you stop that guy? Or why didn't you stop that? We never say, God, why didn't you stop me? It's always somebody else that we're pointing at when we say, why didn't God stop this evil? If he wanted to stop evil, he could start with us. In fact, if God were to stop evil at midnight tonight, would any of us still be alive at 12:01? Nope. So you got to look at the context of these passages, Cordell, to know if something appears contradictory. Now, by the way, the Bible contradicts every culture somewhere. And you would expect that if the Bible was from God. You would expect every culture would disagree with the Bible somewhere. Like, for example, here in America, a lot of people think, well, same-sex behavior is okay, and fornication's okay, premarital sex. But you go to some other countries, and they go, no, those things are wrong. Yet in our country, love your enemies, we go, you know, that's a good ethic. We ought to love our enemies. Or you go to the Middle East and you say, love your enemies, you're going to go, what are you, nuts? You're never going to get anywhere loving your enemies. You need to destroy your enemies, right? So you would expect that an ethic from God would contradict every culture somewhere. And it does.
Thanks, Doc.
Thank you.
Okay, Harden, go ahead. All right. Come off mute, ask your question, bud.
Can you hear me better now?
Yeah.
All right. Thank you. I'm sorry for about earlier. So I was raised on baptism, and I've always wondered, like, why is there other Christian, like, religious, like Catholic and other Methodist? And so, like, I was wondering, like, there's a church in Kansas. It's a Catholic school. And they're so strict that they don't even let the girls talk to the boys. And so I was wondering, like, I went to a Methodist church when I was raised on Baptist once, and their way of doing things was different, was like way different than Baptist. And so I was wondering, if this is the same religion, why is there so much difference in like the three, you know, Methodist, baptism, and Catholic?
Because human beings disagree over almost everything somewhere, right? We could have a common core, but disagree on the peripheral issues. And in fact, if you look at there are three major areas or sects of Christianity. There's Roman Catholicism, Greek Orthodox, and Protestants. Okay. Protestants come from Martin Luther, who in 1517 noticed that the Catholic Church was basically teaching works-based salvation, that the way you get saved is you give money to the church, you have to do good things in addition to the grace you get from Christ. And Martin Luther said, nein, no, in German. That's not what the Bible teaches. He wanted to reform the Catholic Church. That's why it's called the Reformation. But the Catholic Church dug its heels in and said, no, we're going to double down on what we've been teaching. And so Martin Luther split off. And from that split, you get Lutherans, you get Methodists, you get Baptists, you get Anglicans. Okay, that's where those are Protestant denominations. But the denominations or the major groups that believe the Bible all agree on the essentials. They all agree there's a God. They all agree you are not him. They all agree we're sinners, that we need a savior, that Jesus came to save us, and by trusting in him, we can have our sins forgiven, and that Jesus will come again and judge the living and the dead. They all agree on those essentials. They may add some things to that, but they agree on those essentials. So they agree on the core. They disagree on secondary issues. And that's okay. We can disagree on secondary issues. Now, some of these other things that you talked about, Hardin, like, oh, how come this Catholic Church is so strict it won't even let the boys talk to the girls? That's not coming from the Bible. Those are just their traditions. Those are just the ways they think they're going to try and keep people from sin. Okay. And now Jesus warned us about traditions. He said to the Pharisees, you nullify the word of God on account of your traditions. And so we have to be careful that we're not adding things to the Bible and saying, well, the way we do school is definitely the biblical way. We've got to see if it's lining up with the Bible. On the denominations that actually believe the Bible, they agree on a lot more they disagree on. Now, we have a podcast that goes into this. If you get our podcast, it's called the I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist podcast. Go back a year, maybe a year and a half. There's a whole 40-minute or 50-minute show on why are there so many denominations. And so if you want to get more into that, you can check that out. All right.
Got it. Yes, sir.
All right. Thanks.
Awesome. Thanks, Dr. Turek. All right. Last question. Let's go with Nathan.
What would your parting message, guys? I got the last question, so I feel like this would be right. What would your parting message be to us young men going out into the world? I would assume most of us here are Christians or thinking about it because we're here. So what would your message to us be, you know, just going out into the world and the way our world has just been, the degeneracy and just, yeah, I mean, just going out into the world and doing big things and spreading the Lord's word and kind of fighting against the culture now.
Well, the world needs Christian leaders, Christian men. So let me go back to the proverb, guard your heart because everything you do flows from it. Above all else, guard your heart. So follow Jesus, follow the truth. He is the truth and everything else will fall into place. But you got to stand up and lead. You just can't be quiet. You just can't sit in the background. Now our culture is degrading very quickly now. And we might not be able to do all that much to change the culture, but we can ensure that the culture doesn't change us. We might not be able to change the culture very much, but we can sure be sure that the culture doesn't change us, right? So don't bow to the culture. Don't bow to the fad. Jesus said that if they persecute me, they'll persecute you. You might get persecuted for standing for truth. And as Jason will tell you, as I will tell you, when you're in the military, it's a pretty stark line between the believers and the unbelievers. You might take some ribbing. You might be left out of the group because you're a Christian, because you don't do certain things the other guys want to do. That's fine. Your service is to the Lord, not to people. In fact, Paul says, if I was trying to please other people, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing. You're there to stand for Jesus. You're there to be an ambassador. And the people that are interested will be motivated by that. The people who are opposed to you, they're going to hate that, but oh well. Look, if somebody doesn't hate you, you're doing something wrong. So you just get used to not being liked. That's fine. Jesus was innocent, and yet he was murdered. So we could be saved.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I appreciate your time tonight.
All right. Thank you. Thanks for being here, guys. Thanks for the work you want to do for the country and the Lord.
Hey, Dr. Turek, thank you again for taking time out of your night to come here and empower this group. Any final parting words for these young men as they get ready to ship out into their special operations pipelines and do something great for this country, for themselves, and for the Lord?
Yeah, just what I said a minute ago, guard your heart and follow the Lord. And know that what you're doing, if you're following the code of conduct and you're defending the country, defending the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic, you're doing a noble thing. Because without the military and without police, nothing else matters. You can't carry out a normal life without security. And I think it was Edmund Burke who said, the only thing necessary for evil to prevail is for good men to do nothing. So you're standing as a vanguard against evil. That's a good thing and a noble thing.
The only way for evil to prevail is for good men to do nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a great quote to end the night with. Dr. Turek, again, thank you so much for coming on the SOCOM Athletes Podcast. Send me, team, go ahead and come off mute. Say goodbye to Dr. Turek.
Thank you, Dr. Turek.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Adios.
Doctor. Appreciate your time.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys. Hey, Jason. We'll talk soon, man.
We hope you enjoyed this special episode. And if you're still listening, chances are you care and you want to dive deeper into what was discussed. Feel free to shoot us an email, socomathlete@gmail.com. If you enjoyed the podcast and want to support SOCOM Athlete, give back. We have a Patreon fund. You can find the link to that in the caption or Google SOCOM Athlete Patreon. Even just throwing a few bucks in there is huge for the program, as all proceeds go to giving scholarships to our Hell Day events, which have changed the lives of many people that have gone on and become special operators. Another huge way to give back to SOCOM Athlete, if you have an iPhone, is to go over to Apple Podcasts, give us a 5-star written review, let us know why you enjoyed the podcast, give us a recommendation. We appreciate it so much. Thanks again for tuning in to SOCOM Athlete's Podcast. Send me. This is your host, Jason. We are out.
Thank you.
Up.
Down.
Lord.